Well, I guess we'll go ahead and we'll just start, if that's okay with you folks. We're going to start a new tradition of actually kind of starting on time at USIP. So this is really a casual discussion. So if I say something that sounds really silly, doesn't make sense, you need clarification, or I use some word that is not familiar, you know, just give a shout. No reason to go on with something that's not clear. And for those of you who didn't pick it up, you might want to pick it up. I've got some data tables that I pulled together. A couple of them may be valuable because, to my knowledge, the only place they exist is actually in Urdu. So you might just want to, you may find this useful, you may not, when you see how bad the data are. And before I talk about the trip report, I want to just, I'm amazed at how many folks don't know about these resources. This report here, and, you know, it's obviously very accessible for everyone. This is actually a book, Dini Madaris Meitalin, so Education in Religious Schools. And it's actually published by the Institute of Policy Studies in Islamabad. And one of my major grouses with scholarship of madrasas for the past, I don't know, 5 years, is that they actually do not in any way reflect the very robust literature on madrasas that have been around for a very long time. And even though this is in Urdu, if you go to Pakistan, you do interviews, anyone's going to tell you, oh, yes, go get the IPS book. By the way, that's how I found out about it a couple years ago when it came out. And they do, although, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff in here, which relies upon some of the old data that were collected by the Ministry of Religious Affairs in 79, Ministry of Education in 88 and 2000, to my knowledge, the reports are kind of hard to get. In fact, we haven't found the original reports yet, despite, you know, scrounging around pretty diligently, but the data are available here. They do have some interesting tables summarized in this little pamphlet, and you can get all this. I can't believe I'm doing a sales pitch for IPS. You can get this stuff on their website, so it's all available. So with that little show and tell, let me give you a little bit of background to the work that motivated this trip. For some time, I don't know, the last couple of years, I've been increasingly interested in looking at U.S. and government of Pakistan efforts to reform education in Pakistan. I used to work at RAND, so I used to work with probably too many economists for my own good. But unfortunately, that lens of economics has been pretty much beaten into my brain. And many of the studies that I've seen or many of the proposals that I've seen really don't seem cognizant of a very fundamental literature on parental choice. So in other words, in the case of Pakistan, parents are making a sequential decision. Do they send their kids to school? And if so, a conditional choice on what kind of schools to send their children to. And the stuff I've seen available on what the U.S. is interested in doing, and from my conversations with folks in the Pakistani government, there doesn't really seem to be a lot of connectivity to a very robust literature done by the World Bank, for example, on the determinants of educational choice in Pakistan. So it's almost as if they flushed the toilet and we're just starting from scratch. So to me, that's a recipe for disaster. It's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And so I've been really interested in trying to understand what does the literature tell us and how well does what's going on comport with some very well-known economic phenomenon in the educational market. And for those of you who know me, mostly I work on militancy. And I've been very baffled that for so many years we've been fed a pretty steady diet that madrasas are weapons of mass instruction and they're all these, you know, these cute little pithy aphorisms. But the fact is they really don't match onto the data. Now, the last couple of months have seen some what I'd call useful mid-course corrections. So, for example, Sageman's for some time has been, you know, with his analysis saying, you know, hey, dude, these guys are not coming from madrasas. Peter Bergen did a recent piece in the Washington Quarterly. Alexander Evans did a recent piece in Foreign Policy. And while these are very welcome interventions, I'm going to submit to you, they still get it wrong. So let me walk through where I'm coming from on this issue. I think of terrorist organizations, militant organizations, whatever moniker you prefer, these are basically hiring organizations. They are manning their missions in a way not dissimilar from a military. Even McDonald's has quality standards that they impose for their burger flippers. And I assure you, all of the evidence that I've seen on militant organization recruitment, they do the same thing. So when I look at South Asia and I divide up what militants are doing across different theaters, a couple theaters come to mind. There's Indian-administered Kashmir, there's India proper, there's Pakistan, and there's Afghanistan. And when you actually look at the kinds of activities and missions and operations that are happening in each of these theaters, I find it very difficult to believe that the average madrasa student, could actually carry out those operations. So when you take into consideration that that militant organizations have a recruitment standard that they're imposing, and when you consider that there are others who are available who come from a technical training, from colleges and so forth, they don't have to take madrasa students. Even if every single madrasa student, all 1% of them, I might add, throughout the Pakistani educational market, wanted to be a militant, the militant organizations actually don't have to take them. So why did I say that I still think that Bergen and Alexander Evans still get it wrong? Well, I do believe that madrasas do not supply terrorist manpower. I've always believed that. I still believe that. But it may, in fact, be a situation where they do support an environment that supports terrorism. And as it turns, so in other words, if you think about, there's two different supply and demand concepts, and I think the literature and people writing this literature conflates them. There's the demand for manpower from the organization and the supply for manpower. But then if you think about a deed of terrorism being a product, which a lot of economists do, there's a supply of that product being done by the terrorist or militant organization, and then there's the people who demand that product. In other words, its supporters. So it may be the case that madrasa students don't contribute to terrorist manpower or militant manpower, but they may, in fact, contribute to an environment that generally supports the activities of those groups. Now, that's a theoretical position that one could map out, but it turns out that when you actually look at some of the literature, it turns out there's quite a bit of evidence that does support that. So Salim Ali did a project supported by the United States Institute of Peace. And what he found was that where there, and actually, you know, we can talk methodologically about a study a little bit, but he mostly focused on madrasas in several districts in the Punjab. He actually found that when there happens to be a lot of madrasas and the density of madrasas are high, it correlates statistically with an increased propensity for sectarian violence. Another scholar, and I'm really surprised how few people seem to know about this fellow. His name is Tariq Rahman, and when we get there, I've got some of his tables reproduced in this handout. He actually did a survey of about 500 or so students and about 200 or so teachers at madrasas, private schools, and public schools, and he asked them some very provocative questions. He asked them about whether or not they think Kashmir should be taken away from India by open war, support for jihadi groups, whether it should be involved in peaceful means. He also asked some questions about giving Ahmadiyyas equal rights in all jobs, equal rights to Pakistani Hindus, Christians, and whether or not men and women should be given equal rights as in Western countries. And this, by the way, is in tables 8 and 10. I've got both teacher as well as instructor responses. And what he found is, not surprisingly, when you look at the curriculum that students are studying at Madaris, that the Madaris students tend to be more likely to support open war, more likely to support jihad, less likely to be willing to grant different minorities equal rights and so forth. So you can look at that in your own terms. But I did want to bring to your attention the very important work of Salim Ali and also Tariq Rahman. And then finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that the actual impetus for this particular trip that I took, about which I'm going to tell you, this was actually a collaborative effort with the National Bureau of Asian Research, and I'm very happy to be working with Vali Nasser. The particular focus on madrasas is not driven by any belief that madrasas in particular are more problematic than other sectors, but rather that we're all doing a very similar methodology in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. And then we've also, we're following on the heels of the Southeast Asian Islamic Education Survey that's being led by Bob Hefner. So we're all kind of traipsing out in the field with very similar instruments. And so thus the first focus on Islamic schools this particular year. So having given a sort of, you know, background of, you know, the different kinds of inquiries that this trip is feeding into, let me first tell you a little bit about the sample that we selected, because the sample that we selected, well, it's very small, it's a convenient sample, but basically we had identified 13 different madrasas, and 13 out of 13,000 is obviously nothing, so you get an idea of how minuscule this is, but nonetheless, this was an instructive exercise. Because we picked the madrasas that were, and as I'll explain to you, madrasas in Pakistan are associated with what's called five vafaqs, or five boards. And I provided on table two the name of the vafak, the sect with which that vafak is affiliated, as well as the date in which they are founded and where they're currently headquartered. So that's all available in table two, and I don't want to beat you up with it. But as you'll see in the other data tables, the largest market share of madrasas are actually Deobandis. So we wanted in our sample size to both reflect the general distribution of these different vafaks, geographical distribution. In other words, we didn't want to leave out Baluchistan, or we didn't want to leave out Sindh. And the other considerations are the numbers of students they have, the number of ulama they produce, some sense of prestige. So we identified 13 of these schools, and we did, in fact, visit all but three of them. One we couldn't get to because of road closures because of the cartoon controversy, one we couldn't get to because the teacher died, and my favorite, one we couldn't get to because the Nazim was evading arrest. So that was very exciting. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you a little bit about the terminology that I'm using. And I'm putting this out here because if any of this is discordant with what you think a madrasa is or should be defined, let me know. So I want to clarify the terms that I'm using, for purposes of discussion. I think it's fair to say, hey, Anil, Islamic education in Pakistan, there are basically four levels. There's primary called, if you don't have to write it down, it's all in table one. Stick up a table? Yeah. Okay. Ibtidai, which is primary, Mutawassita, which is the middle. Then you have different levels of what's called higher education, Fahani. And then in addition, there's a sort of postgraduate syllabus that some madrasas have in very specialized topics. And generally, only the most prestigious madrasas have these specializations because they're very time intensive. So, for example, to be a mufti requires a postgraduate specialization in iftah. And one of my favorite things was when I went to these madrasas, and these, like I said, these are high-end madrasas that we visited. I mean, they get far more applicants than they have seats for. So in some sense, we went to the Yales, and we were not able to visit the Ball State. Since I'm from Indiana, I can say Ball State. So we really did go to the, that was a joke. Hope no one actually went to Ball State. Okay, IPFW, Fort Wayne. So for one of my favorite parts of visiting the madrasas was actually to go to the iftah department, because you'll often hear madrasa people talk about their movement into information technologies. And until I went, I was kind of confused. Like, are we supposed to believe that madrasa graduates are going to become data entry folks? No. The reason why they're using internet technologies is because they want to be able to interface with the Muslim and non-Muslim world more effectively. And when I went to Jamia Banuria in Karachi, they have a very active iftah department. And basically, it's a 24-hour Ask a Mufti service. And you can, email your requests in. And they actually get a very interesting and broad array of requests. But basically, they're using internet technologies to sort of expand their presence throughout the world and to be able to control the message about Islam much more effectively. They actually, I think, have a much more sophisticated perception management strategy than perhaps Karen Hughes. But we'll table that discussion for another time. So for those of you who've been sort of, whipsawed by the literature on madrasas for the past 5 years, I mean, you've all seen these dizzying array of estimates. My favorite was a European Commission report said there were 80,000 madrasas in Pakistan. And of course, none of these have been substantiated. Part of the problem, I suspect, is that we're defining the unit of madrasa in ways that are fundamentally different. Madrasa comes from the Arabic root dars, just means school. So anything really could be a madrasa. And so you'll often hear Pakistanis affix dini before madrasa, specifically referencing Islamic schools. They often get confused with another school called a maktab. And I used to think, before I did this fieldwork, actually, that these were very clearly analytically distinct concepts. And in fact, they really aren't. And whereas I used to laugh at folk for not getting it right, now I see how, in fact, difficult it is to get right. In fact, there's a lot of overlap. But generally, a maktab is distinguished from a madrasa in the following way. Madrasas tend to be very small. Maybe 30 kids are being educated at a time. They tend to not have residential areas, so you don't have people coming in from outside to attend a maktab. They're often associated with the mosque. That doesn't help much because, in fact, a lot of madrasas are associated with mosques. But the real difference I find in distinguishing between the two concepts is actually in the scope of their curriculum. Maktabs almost invariably are primary educational establishments. So what does that mean? You'll find in Table 1 that I kind of wrote out what kind of activities generally happen for each of these levels of education. And usually what maktabs do, they just teach kids to read the Quran. And you know, it's very rare that a student would be at a maktab beyond the point of the third grade. The sine qua non of a madrasa is actually the curriculum that they use. And the curriculum that they use is called Darse Nizami. And for most Sunni Muslims, and they're, you know, the Sunni Muslims are going to be El Hadith, Bareilly, Deobandi, and then of course there's Jamaat Islami as well as the Shia Muslim. The Darse Nizami is about an 8-year program. And if you look at Table 1 again, I sort of break out what. So basically, the first degree that you get as a part of Darse Nizami is Sanviya Amma. So that is, you can sit for the exam after about the first 2 years as Darse Nizami. And I walk you through what the final degree is with this Shahadatul Alamiya. Now, in the Pakistani government, this final degree, and if I'm speaking too fast or really boring you, also let me know. The final degree is considered to be equivalent to a master's in Islamic studies as well as Arabic, the Arabic language. Although I've given the sort of comparable to the mainstream system, know that these, while they are comparable, they're not actually considered to be equivalent. I'm just trying to benchmark for you what's going on. So this is really, in my view, analytically what makes many madrasas distinct from a maktab. But here's where the situation gets really difficult. Because as you progress along Darse Nizami and the subjects become increasingly more complex, you have to have faculty that are able to impart that instruction. So there are many madrasas that actually don't go to the terminal degree, and we can call them secondary madrasas. And so then the overlap between a maktab and these secondary madrasas actually become very difficult because sometimes they seem to be doing very similar things. Another complicating factor that I found is that because many of these madrasas have very, it's fair to say it, brand name equity, they will have a main campus where they'll do the full Darse Nizami curriculum, and then they'll have several satellites where maybe they'll do Nazara or maybe Hifz-e Quran. Hifz-e Quran is the memorization of the Quran. And I can't say elsewhere, but certainly in South Asia, it is very prestigious to have one of your children become what's called Hafiz, you know, the protector of the Quran. And, you know, and I have to say, I think about my niece, who, if we were in Pakistan, would be starting her Hifz program. I think she'd have difficulty remembering a menu at McDonald's, much less the entirety of the Quran. And it's not just remembering the words. There's also the correct pronunciation and various poetics that are involved as well. So anyway, so this gives you some insight, I think, into how it is that we have estimates that are as low as 6,000 on one hand and 80,000 on another, because, in fact, analytically, it's really not very clear. Let me talk a little bit about what do we really think are the numbers of madrasas. Now, to be straight up with you, I really don't care. But this seems to be something that everyone else seems to care about tremendously. But let me walk you through some of the tables that I put together. My biggest grouse with Jessica Stern and that crowd is that they actually show no reference to the fact there's a pretty big literature on madrasas, and including the fact that the Pakistani government themselves have done a number of surveys of madrasas. But I'd like to put a question out, and if any of you have any ideas, I'd be very grateful. So let's take a look at Table 3. So this is as of 2000, and again, this is using data from the Ministry of Education, 6,741 madrasas. Now here's what I'm confused by. Jessica Stern, all these folks got their data from interviews with government officials. How could they be getting data that are so discordant from, I don't know, published sources? I can't explain it, but I've been racking my brain to sort of make these numbers fit, and I find it very confusing. I think part of the problem is that we've got different kinds of data sources. And establishment data, which all of these are, which is, in other words, someone goes and asks the district nazim, or someone goes and asks the administrator of a madrasa, tell me, you know, who you are, where do you exist, or relying upon archived registration of madrasas. There's a lot of different biases in these kinds of data. And I suspect that's why these numbers are so very low. Because if you look at the way in which these madrasas are registered, and I'd like to make some grouse about that too, many of the important madrasas have already been registered. They registered in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. They were registered at the time that the madrasas were formed, and they were registered under the Society's Registration Act of 1860, and they're registered for the same reason that folks here register 501c3. They want more money. So madrasas found it effective to be registered under the SRA to get money. So we'll talk a little bit about what's the new flap over registration. But the bottom line is, if you look at the way these madrasas are registered, there's no comprehensive database, there's no file out there that has them all. Someone has to go knock on the district, well, now the district knows them, and say, hey, give me the headcount for madrasas in your district. And so you can see the problems associated with this. So in my sense, when people say, how many madrasas are there, I'm like, I really don't care right now, because there are no data sources that are going to give us a good answer, and I've got better things to worry about. That being said, the Ministry of Education rightly understands that if it's going to control quality and if it's going to have some way of being able to control the products that come out of all educational establishments, not just madrasas, I might add, by the way, that one of the biggest complaints that madrasa administrators have is that private schools don't have to register, so why do we have to register? The more kids going to private schools and madrasas, so what's the fuss about with us? So the Ministry of Education is launching a very comprehensive census of all education schools by district. And this is currently underway. There's actually a website where you can see some of the progress that's being made. So it may be the case that in a couple of years, you know, we'll actually be able to say something sensible. In the meantime, we can't, so let's move on. But let's talk about something that I think is more interesting, which is the overall market share of students who attend madrasas. Now, again, we've seen dizzying numbers about this as well. At one point, the ICG reported that 33% of students went to madrasas. Now, any of you that have hung out in Pakistan know this is utter nonsense. I couldn't fathom, where are these 1 in 3 kids hiding? They all went to madrasas. Because anyone who spent time in Pakistan, it never made any sense, that number. And it turns out, the reason why it didn't make any sense, I got their math wrong. When they took the numbers of madrasa students, which they got from the Ministry of Religious Affairs, and they divided by the total number of all enrolled students, they should have divided by 19 million. Instead, they divided by 1.9 million. So they were off by an order of magnitude. I know, it's embarrassing, but we've all done it. So the only study that, in my view, really gets to the bottom of this madrasa nonsense is the World Bank. And some of you have seen the World Bank study. How many of you have seen the World Bank study? Okay. Well, I wasn't going to go into it, but I guess I will. The World Bank did something, along with the Kennedy School, they did something very provocative. They actually looked for data. And when you look for something, you sometimes find it. Turns out it was underneath all of our noses. And speaking of which, I felt like the biggest dork, because I've actually used these data sets, and it never occurred to me that I could have used them for this analysis. When I was at RAND, I looked at the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey in the Pakistani Census, which we bought for your project. I'm looking right at the instrument, and there should have been, you know, a eureka moment, but no, the eureka moment passed me too. But the folks at the World Bank, they looked at these four data sets, three waves of the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey. The Pakistani Integrated Household Survey is respondent-level data. The Pakistani Census is the other data that they use, and that was fielded in 1998. It's not respondent-level, it's district-level data. But what they were able to do using those data is they were able to estimate the overall market share that go to madrasas. So what they found was that about 1% or fewer actually attend madrasas, 1% or fewer. Let that soak in for a while, because it blew me away as well, because this would not be the perception that you got after reading, you know, the barrage of things about madrasas as weapons of mass instruction. 70% of students went to public schools. 30% went to private schools. And I have to say, I was somewhat surprised by the private school figure, because certainly from the American experience, we think of private schools as being very expensive. And given the socioeconomics of Pakistan, prima facie, I would not have thought it would be that high. But the fact is, not all private schools are expensive, and they're, you know, for example, Zakat can fund students who attend private schools. So that's the overall market share. However, they did find very interesting variation geographically. So, for example, in districts, and again, for those of you who haven't seen it, Andrabi is the lead author. Go to Google, you'll find it. Andrabi, religious school enrollment in Pakistan, a look at the data, you'll find it. And they, what they've done, they've graphically imaged the density of madrasa enrollments throughout the country. And while overall it's about 1%, what you do find is a lot of variation geographically. So not surprisingly, for those of us who remember what we did during the Cold War and our efforts to get the Soviets out, the belt lined up against the Afghan border, that's where you see some of the highest madrasa density, the density of madrasa enrollment. And there we see figures between 2 and 5, and in Pashin, it actually goes as high as 7%. So using these data sets, we're able to get some idea of what is the overall market share of madrasas, and as far as I'm concerned, it makes a very good argument of where resources should be focusing, probably not on 1%, when 70% attend public schools, and 30%, of course, attend private schools. But they next wanted to understand what explains the variation in one household that will send their kid to a madrasa and another household that doesn't. Now, this is where, for those of you who have seen the study or are familiar with some of the popular grouses about the study, this is where the grousers are really, I think, out of their lane. The problem with econometric analyses, and for any of you, do all of you remember econometrics from school? what econometrics allows an analyst to do is to make comparisons in a much more controlled way. Let me give you an example. If we were to line up men and women and ask them how they voted in an election, and we saw a difference between the way men and women said they would vote, most people would say, oh, this is the gender difference. Well, maybe there is a gender difference, but there may be something else about the underlying distribution of the population. Maybe women were more well-educated than men. Maybe the women had different work patterns and it enabled them to vote at different times. I mean, there are any number of explanations. But the point is that unless you control for those differences, you end up attributing to a gender divide what in fact may be due to underlying distributional differences on top of which gender gets laid. So in an econometric analysis, what we're trying to do, let's take everyone in the room, and we have a list of 7 things that we know about each and every single person, their gender, their education, whether they're married, their age category, and so forth. And we put only in one corner all of those people who are identical in every way except gender. Then we ask the question, how did you vote? Then we could say, conditioned on all of these other things being held constant, this is the part in their difference in voting that's attributable to gender. So this is a long way of saying, going back to what the World Bank people tried to do, they were trying to explain what makes a madrasa household differ from a non-madrasa household. Now, the problem is that madrasas are such a rare event in the data. So, for example, we couldn't use the census data because that's only district level. So we have to rely on the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey data. It's such a rare event that you then can't get statistically significant results in your model. So what they had to do was they had to go into areas where they could get enough households with enough madrasa enrollments where they could do an econometric analysis and then have something intelligent to say about the differences. So what they did, they went, and this is where everyone, you know, jumped up and down about, oh, they went to the Punjab, and the Punjab isn't the place where madrasas are, which, oh, by the way, the Punjab is the place where the madrasas are because it happens to be the most populous of the provinces, and madrasas track population, so I'm not even sure why that's been so damaging to the World Bank study. But nonetheless, they went into 3 districts in the Punjab because they needed at least 1,000 households had to go to madrasas before you could control for all of these factors and say something intelligent. But what they found when they did this was that there was more variation within a household than there was between households. So unfortunately, this meant that when you're using household data to explain variations within a household, you're obviously not going to get very far. But I want to point out one of the findings, and then when we talk about some of the stuff that came up during the interviews, I want you to remember it because it turns out to be, I think, important. They found that of madrasa households, which they defined by at least one kid at a madrasa, only 23% of them had all kids at a madrasa. The vast majority had a mixed educational strategy. One kid at a madrasa, and the other kids either went to a public school, a private school, or some mix thereof. And, you know, there are a bunch of other things we can talk about that data, but because they were statistically, how shall we say, they weren't insignificant, but because you're using household-based data to explain within household differences, it gets to be really, well, there's no point in having that discussion here, but we can certainly talk about it more offline. So this is a sort of overview of what a madrasa is. Let me just walk you through these tables so that you're not scribbling down notes. Table one kind of gives you the level of the different education that's available at Islamic schools. Two tells you the five boards. And most people believe that the vast majority of madrasas are affiliated with one of these five boards. Table three and table four, as well as table five, give you some data about the sect-wise as well as region-wise expansion of madrasas. And some of these data, to my knowledge, are only available in Urdu, which is why I went ahead and made this, because you might find it useful for your records. Table 6 summarizes the top-level results from the World Bank findings, which is the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey and the Census. And before leaving this topic altogether, I want to bring your attention to one thing. Take a look at 1998 for the PIHS as well as the Census. And what you'll find is, even though these are very different data sets, different sample structures, different ways of which the questions were asked, the results, given all of those differences, are actually quite similar. So from my point of view, this is pretty reassuring to me that the World Bank team is getting something right. So let's talk a little bit about the actual interviews that we did in Pakistan. I first want to say that none of this could be possible without a young analyst. Actually, he's not so young. He's about my age. We're not young anymore. Rashid Bukhari. Rashid Bukhari used to work at the Institute for Policy Studies. This is him. I wish that he were here in the room, but unfortunately or fortunately, he is in Islamabad. So I really want to thank Rashid. And also, before we go on, thank Karim. Many of you RSVP'd to Karim. Karim's not here, but thank you, Karim, because Karim made this possible. And he's leaving for law school very soon. And I'll be very less productive without Karim. So let's talk a little bit about the folks we interviewed. So in addition to the madrasa people, we also interviewed people in the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Religious Affairs. We also went to great lengths to meet with people who are, they got feet in both canoes. They've both served in the government, either in the capacity of, you know, being in the Ministry of Religious Affairs, or maybe they've served in the cabinet, but they're also very clearly madrasa establishment people. And so I was really interested in hearing their views about what's happening, what needs to happen, and why. So the government people were pretty clear when you asked them, why do you care about madrasas? They're 1% of the population. I think the most direct thing I heard was from the minister himself. And he said, look, we want madrasa students to be more employable, and I quote, socially acceptable. So you don't get, there's not too much of a fine point you can put on that. He's very clear. Most of the folks that we interviewed recognized that what they were asking the madrasas to do is, in fact, difficult. But they were incredibly optimistic that, in fact, deep down inside all of these madrasa administrators was a compliant administrator that was just chomping at the bit to enact upon all of these reforms. I found their optimism to be very refreshing. Persons outside of the MOE, going back to the people with feet in different canoes, you know, they actually had a different point of view, because they're in a really interesting subject position of both understanding the objectives of the government while also inherently understanding, because they are in fact part of the madrasa establishment, the equities of those organizations. And they made a number of very interesting points, and they actually resonate with some of my questions, the empirical questions going into the fieldwork. First of all, their belief, and I agree with them, this is an area of much more necessary research. It was their belief that in the last 10 to 15 years, whereas madrasa, the prestige of madrasa education had really been on a steady decline, and part of it is, I can give this to anyone who's interested, I went through and I've sort of transcribed the textbooks that are used in the Dars-e-Nizami syllabus. And what you'll see is that the syllabus has really two kinds of subjects, if you will. One is that what's called the received knowledge or the received sciences, and mostly these are going to be Islamic subjects. Most of those texts are classical. We're talking 7th century. The most recent of them is 11th century. And all of these texts are in Arabic. So that what's interesting about the madrasas, all the texts are in Arabic. The method of instruction is often Urdu or Sindhi, or depending on where the madrasa is located. The other subjects include math, include medicine, include astronomy. And initially, I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And I thought, go madrasas for a second. Then I was told that these, like, for example, geometry, they study Euclides. astronomy, Ptolemy. I mean, we're looking at Greek texts translated into Arabic. The medical text uses a Pakistani luminary, Ibn Sina. He is, in fact, a luminary. However, his work does date to, I believe, the 14th century, and pathology has moved on. Mm-hmm. So what's very interesting when you talk to these people who kind of represent both equities, their point is madrasas are supposed to be producing ulama. No one asks the medical school, why aren't you teaching hadith? Very good point. So why are you asking us to be teaching this other stuff? But their point is, and very few madrasa administrators that we interviewed conceded this point directly, although they danced around the bush quite a bit. The point that we got talking to folks, by the way, thank you, Karim. We're just thanking you. And again, congratulating you on law school and your all together too soon departure. Their point is that because the function of madrasas is to produce ulama, the fact that they are being educated in these so-called worldly subjects, and they use the word worldly because secular, unfortunately, in Urdu translates to having no religion, you know, atheism, they Muslim without faith, so they use the word worldly, which is, so I will probably use that term too. But because they are studying these worldly subjects, but they're doing so with medieval texts, it creates ulama that are very frankly out of date with the modern world. And so Islamic scholars in Pakistan, their concern is, this isn't your concern, meaning the U.S. government or whoever, it's our concern that we are an Islamic country and we're being led by ulama who think that Ibn Sina has the last word on pathology. And it was very interesting to me that this was, in fact, their point of view. The other point that they made, although it was denied vigorously by virtually every single nazim or administrator that we met, is that madrasas do contribute to sectarian violence. As I said, the work of Salim Ali, at least in the provinces in the Punjab, he looks at makes a pretty convincing case that this is true. And it actually makes quite a bit of sense when, again, you look at their curriculum. A huge component of their curriculum is what's called RUD. RUD means, like, the rejection. So much of their curriculum is, in fact, bolstering the logic on the superiority of their maslak. And maslak, I guess, that's hard to make sense with a school sect, maybe. I don't know if you use sect, because then it gets conflated with Shia Sunni. Within the Sunni tradition, there are different flavors of being a Sunni. And so when they teach the Darse Nizami, a lot of what they do is about... Schools. A lot of what they do is really bolstering the position that theirs is the superior school relative to others. Now, here's another thing that I thought was really fascinating from interviewing what I would call the establishment Islamic scholars. We were at the Council of Islamic Ideology, and I nearly, literally my chin was on the floor when the person we were interviewing, who was a senior researcher, said that 97% of Muslims in Pakistan are Hanafi. For those of you who know how many Shia there are in Pakistan, would be flabbergasted by that response. So in his mind, Shia weren't even Muslims. And I said, how can you say that? You've got like 15 to 25% Shia, depending on, you know, how you make your assessments. Because actually in many parts of Pakistan, the northern areas are not included in census where many Shias reside. So it's actually very, when you see numbers about Shia in Pakistan, take it with a convoy of salt, because there's actually no scientifically robust way of getting at those figures. So this utterly blew me away, that he had this view. He went on to then explain that, in his view, the majority of Pakistanis, in addition to being Hanafi, are in fact Deobandis. And I said, well, that's very peculiar, because you're the first person that I've ever heard say this, because most people believe that folks are Barelvi. And this gentleman, again, a head researcher of the Council of Islamic Ideology, said, but yes, but they're all deluded. If they were only educated and they were sophisticated, they're following the wrong path. because any true Muslim in Pakistan will be a Deobandi. So it's very interesting, you know, it's not the stuff that they say per se, it's how they say it and the context in which they say it. But it really struck me, these are the folks in the Council of Islamic Ideology, which is a constitutional body in Pakistan, and yet these are some of the views that are being freely shared with a foreigner, with a tape recorder, with no illusion that this is an off-the-record comment. So, again, I think, is there anything else that I... Yeah, there's... Oh, yes. Going back to the people who've got feet in both canoes, they made some interesting points, and it goes back to the World Bank data, and it really did hit me aside the head like a ton of bricks. They said that there is a backfire, there is a backlash, that because many people in Pakistan understand, I think correctly, to no offense to the USG folks in the room, that the reason why the U.S. is interested in getting Pakistan to reform the curriculum is to basically de-Islamicize it. In other words, why is jihad being taught in the biology curriculum? And so I don't think Pakistanis would be remiss in coming to the conclusion that we're leaning on our Pakistani friends to basically clean up that curriculum. Well, the problem is if you're not reforming education, and I'm going to go back to this point about parental choice, with some cognizance of what parents want in educating their kids, the market will outfool you. It will outsmart you every time. So one of the things that we were very much on the lookout was to see, you know, basically when there's a market failure, there are other ways of clearing the market. And so it turns out that there are, in fact, some very interesting Islamic schools being set up that are catering to the taste of the elite who feel as if in private schools they may be getting a Cambridge curriculum, but their kids aren't good Muslims. In other words, that this is something that they value and they feel like they're not getting it in the available educational choices. So as a consequence, there have been a number of schools that are set up. One of them it's got a very long name, I'm just going to use ICRA is a shorthand. ICRA began in Karachi, and it came out of the sense that the public schools have a crappy curriculum, no one's getting employed, there's a short shrift to Islamiyat, and the private schools don't really accommodate our interest in having good Muslims as children. So ICRA is one of the systems that have been set up, but there have been several. Tamiri Milat, Al-Khuda, I mean, there's the examples abound. And we actually did our best to visit some of these schools. I got some of their information on their curriculum. And the first thing that struck me is that they are not cheap. They are, in fact, expensive. They're as expensive as any private school, which tells me the parents who send their kids here have other options, and they are voting with their feet. All the more evidence, I would suggest, that when we think about curriculum reform, we really have to think about parents. They are the agents. They are deciding whether to educate their children, and if so, where they're going to educate their children. If we don't take their views into consideration, the market will in other ways. And for those people that can afford this, it can easily be subverted. So I also want to point out about these schools, they really are a new phenomenon. Most of the schools that we visited, and again, this was in addition to the madrasa sample, we went out of our way to sort of try to find some of these new interesting market solutions, if you will. They're really new. Very few of them even have graduated any number of cohorts, so we can't really assess their quality. So in other words, do they do what they say they're going to do, which is produce a quality education with a solid Islamic grounding? Once they start getting cohorts produced, it'll be very easy to assess that, because then we can look, all of them will be sitting for their local school boards, and we'll be able to benchmark those students relative to students from other schools that are sitting for the same local board exams. But in many cases, the schools are so new that they haven't even had one cohort graduate yet. So just this does give you a sense that this is a relatively new phenomenon, that we don't even have any data that we can analyze. The other thing that struck me when talking to these people with feet in both canoes, because they really understand the concerns of both parties, so I said to them, as I'll talk a little bit about the Nazim or the administrator interviews, many of the madrasas have already introduced curriculum reform. They did it long before the Musharraf government told them to. As I said, many of them were, in fact, already registered. So I asked them, so they're already doing this stuff, so what is the hullabaloo about? And what I was told, and as I went and I did these interviews, it really did seem true. These are empires. The reason why they don't want to register is because part of the registration process, although they backed away from it, and they backed away from it because of the resistance from the administrators, they want detailed information about their finances. Well, any of you who've gone to some of these big madrasas will see immediately that these are I mean, they're just empires. I went to Jamia Benouria, and they have like a 120 canal property, which I don't know, several city blocks, with a large number of private sector enterprises like restaurants, marriage halls. All of this funds these activities, and of course, the community and large business traders throw lots of cash at these madrasas as well in the form of zakat. And if you look at the way the folks who run these schools live, it's a good job to be running a madrasa. It looks to be, from my estimate, I don't know, maybe a couple dozen families actually run these things. So this business is good, and it's a family-run affair. And it was always interesting when I met with madrasa administrators, said, oh, you know, we're Pakistan's biggest NGO. And I couldn't help but point out, well, that's really funny, because no NGO that I know in Pakistan is an inherited position monopolized by three dozen families with completely unchecked financial revenue. But nonetheless, it does appear to be this is a huge source of resistance in these madrasas playing ball with the government. It's not that they're hiding terrorists underneath the Qurans, but rather these are just lucrative, and they want to protect their financial equities. The other thing that struck me in talking to these folks, so I said, okay, they're already doing this stuff. Well, let's leave aside the financial issue. What are some of the other barriers that you anticipate or that you see coming from the madrasa people? And the point that they made, and again, that I followed this through in my interviews at the different madrasas, that many of these people that run these madrasas are also very well connected to the political party with which their madrasa is affiliated. So, for example, the Deobandis are affiliated with JUI. That means that they take their cues from Fazlur Rahman or Samuel Huq or whoever. And so it means that even though they may make a deal in private with the government that, yes, this is a good idea, we're on board for this, as soon as word gets out the deal is broken, because these folks are also political folk, they have to make a lot of hullabaloo to sort of save their, you know, to protect their political equity. So it means that these, you never really know what is the true face. The face that they say when they're on a podium, ostensibly under the guise of protesting the cartoons, or is it what they actually say when they're interacting with officials of the government of Pakistan? So it really does make dealing with these people very difficult. And once I had this insight, I suddenly understood all of the different press accounts of madrasas and their purported recalcitrance. They made a deal, then they went back. It's not that. It's not that they made a deal and they went back. It just wasn't clear the deal was ever made. And so dealing with these folks, it's always like a circus mirror. You really never know which vision of these folks you're actually dealing with at any given time. So let's talk now. Most of this, the points I just made, really comes from talking to people in the government or talking to people who are in the Islamic establishment who are also at various times serving in the government. So let's talk a little bit about what we found talking to these madrasa administrators. What really struck me, and again, there was no pretense that these were off the record. We had a recorder right here. It was all very clear that this was recorded. What very much struck me was their absolute recalcitrance to anything the government of Pakistan said will be done, should be done, or what have you. In fact, one madrasa that we visited, and I'm actually not going to tell you the name of the madrasa because you'll be able to identify who told us this, actually threatened force. And they were able to threaten force because their affiliation with these political parties. So, you know, this, now maybe they were just posturing, but, you know, obviously they knew there was going to be a trip report, and they knew I'd invite people from the embassy. So maybe I was part of their sort of information management campaign. Who knows? But I was very struck that all across the board, there's absolute recalcitrance to this. And part of the recalcitrance was, it was the perception we're already doing this, and this is very clearly, you know, Musharraf is Bush's puppet, you know, the usual stuff that we all hear. But some of the other things that struck me was actually looking at what the madrasas have already done and what they actually do and what the students at madrasas do. Because I have to say, it's one thing to read about them, and it's another thing to actually go to the madrasas and actually see for yourself. So you'll often hear people say that, you know, madrasas are sort of the outposts. There was a foreign policy piece, outposts of medievalism or something like that. But many madrasas that we visited, and I want to say very clearly that these are going to be the high-end madrasas. We can't say anything about these secondary madrasas because they wouldn't speak with us, actually. They wouldn't speak with us because I'm American, because I'm female. There's a whole litany of reasons. The cartoons, America runs Denmark. And, yeah. Yeah, there were a number of reasons. Many of them were humorous, but we couldn't actually meet the secondary madrasas, and in part they also deferred to their leadership at the board. So we were able to basically go to the high-end madrasas, so the Yales and so forth, and then we were able to go to the kindergartens, but really nothing in between. So really restricting these comments to the sample of madrasas that we visited. These guys get so many applicants per seat that they can impose whatever quality constraint they want, because there's always going to be more applicants than there are spaces for those applicants. Many of these madrasas in the last several years have imposed the requirement that students be matriculate graduates. So in other words, that they have at least accomplished the 10th grade in another school system. So this goes back to their point, since they're already taking, in the Pakistani school system, it's after the 10th grade that you would actually begin your specialization. You do your FA, then your BA, and what have you. So to their point of view, if they're only taking students who come in with a 10th grade education already, that they are truly comparable to any other specialization in Pakistan. Now, all of that looked really good until we actually started nosing around the classroom. And it was very clear, there were a lot of kids in there. There is no way they had done the 10th grade. And then we came back and we said, but that kid clearly looked like he was in 7th grade. So explain this. And they said, well, yes, we do make exceptions. So on their website and in their literature, they all say we have this requirement. But when you actually go around to the different classrooms, you actually see the majority of students did appear to be of that age group where that criteria was satisfied, but they did clearly make some exceptions. The other thing that struck me about these madrasa nazams, the administrators, so as I may have mentioned, this is a family enterprise. So these folks got their job in most cases. There are some exceptions. In most cases, these folks appear to get their jobs because they happen to be the son or the brother-in-law or what have you of the guy who had the job before. So many of the nazams that we met, we just got into the habit of asking him, well, where did you do your schooling? And I was surprised how many of these guys have absolutely no madrasa background at all. We then asked them, well, where are your children going to school? If you think this is a great plan, where are your kids hanging out? Many of these madrasa guys did not even have their own kids studying in madrasas, although they would often say, well, it is my hope that at least one of my sons will do Darsi Nizami. So I was struck by, on the one hand, this is such a good thing for everyone else, but it's not good enough for them, and it's not good enough for their own children. The other thing that struck me about these things, about these, they're businesses, and they've got really good brand name equity. Jamia Ashrafia, Khair al-Mudarris, Jamia Banuria, Banuri Town, these are all excellent madrasas, and they're known for their ulama. They have brand name equity. Yet one of their ventures that they were going into was not just setting up new madrasas, but also setting up public schools. So Khair al-Mudarris has done this, Jamia Ashrafia, and you know, we actually had the luxury of visiting some of these model schools. And what they do is very aggressive. And in some cases, I think so aggressive that I doubt that can actually be done with quality. And again, generally these are new phenomenon. But they'll take, say, a Cambridge curriculum, and they will intersperse it with the Darsi Nizami curriculum. So instead of being done in 8 years, maybe it'll take 12 years. But the point is, and in some cases, these public schools don't even have Darsi Nizami. They are teaching the very same curriculum as the other public schools are in that locality. So again, another irony, even though they're defending very much the institution, they're catching where the market's going. Maybe the market isn't just teaching Darsi Nizami. Maybe the market is that parents want a conventional education, but because they're doing it under the auspices of a madrasa, parents' concerns about their children having a proper Islamic background are appropriately assuaged. So that these particular market dynamics of these schools set up by madrasas, these new schools that are not set up under madrasas, for example, like Iqra, Tamir Milat, et cetera, I think this is an area that we should really be looking at, because one, it does seem as if parents are seeking these schools out. They're not funded. Parents pay for these schools. So it does seem as if this is something that parents want. Parents are willing to pay for it. And if, in fact, the students of these schools are scoring it on exams comparable to their peers at other institutions, this is actually something that we might want to really think about. It's something that's being very positive in the educational market in Pakistan. Do you have a question? Oh, okay. Let's see here. I think that I might just shut up because I've been yakking for a long time. But yeah, there was one other thing that I thought was really interesting. So most of the madrasas, they're free, right? Virtually everything is paid for. And there is this perception that only poor kids go to madrasas. And at least for the madrasas that we visited, I mean, that really did not appear to be true. Now, of course, we're trusting madrasa interlocutors, and they have an incentive to tell me that, oh, yes, the very wealthiest people come to our school because it is so good. Now, of course, they have an incentive to inflate that. But where possible, we did ask for administrative data. And what's funny about these madrasas is that some of them were really good on the administrative side. Like, they could go, they were able to print out a data sheet, how many students are residential, how many come from the outside, how many of them are foreign, how many of them get a stipend, how many don't. And some of these madrasas couldn't even tell me how many students they had, even to the first order approximation. So it was very interesting to see the variance in the level of confidence that these administrators had and sort of presenting information about their school, which, quite frankly, we weren't asking anything too complex. We were not asking, you know, the construction specifications of the mosque on the premises. We're asking them pretty basic information. But in the cases where madrasas did provide us information about students receiving stipends, I was really surprised to see that, given the perception that, you know, these are poor kids that come here, maybe two-thirds were not getting stipends. Now, it's really difficult. I mean, what does it really mean? Madrasas, in some cases, collect financial information about the children, but they would only collect this information if the student requested further financial aid, so in other words, a stipend. And so what does a stipend mean? Basically, it's pocket money, because virtually everything else is paid for. Sometimes there'll be an administrative fee of like 1,000 rupees, but for the most part, for boys, madrasas are free, and there's also a stipend. But for girls, and with only one exception did we encounter, they are not free. So families who send their girls to madrasas are paying in the same way they'd pay for any other school. Now, girls also have an abbreviated Dars-e-Nizami curriculum of 6 years. And to give you a sense, too, of how sometimes clueless some of the administrators were, I said, okay, I understand the sequential degree awarding for the male Dars-e-Nizami curriculum is 8 years. It makes sense. Everything happens in two-year increments. How do you award degrees for the girls' curriculum because it's 6 years? What's the synchrony of this? I did not find a single administrator who could tell me the schedule on which they award girls' degrees. I just thought that was very surprising. But I asked them, okay, so why is it that the girls' education is not free? And their perception was that overwhelmingly, and of course we have no way of independently verifying this, but overwhelmingly that the girls are coming from better families and that this education helps them get better grooms. So in other words, there are sort of there are social advantages conferred to girls who study the madrasa. And when I asked them, and I asked this of all the madrasa administrators that we met, so why do you have an abbreviated curriculum for girls instead of the 8 years for boys? And how are you possibly imparting the same degree? How is this the same degree, given that you're clearly abbreviating it? They're not teaching the same books, although they're teaching the same subjects. The reason why it's abbreviated is to accommodate a lower age of marriage. So they're trying to basically accommodate families' interests, the girls be Islamically grounded to get better grooms, while also not sort of, if you will, pricing them out of the marriage market by having them go on the marriage market well past their sell-by date. And ask them to get married well past their sell-by date. I really understood that logic. They didn't have to convince me of this. Once you hit 37, it's really hard to get hitched in this country, so I can imagine in Pakistan it would be a lot more difficult. So I'm going to shut up because I've talked too much. And so let's just have a discussion if that's okay. Or not. Hi, Larry.
Sorry, I was late. Just on your last point there, are you sure that they give the girls any degree other than grooming them for the MRS degree?
Actually, I did ask that. Not as directly. No, because we did ask, can you tell us how many students actually are graduating in this class and how many are getting the Alamia degree? And they did actually provide. But my suspicion was, because no one could tell me if they actually gave the earlier degrees, if they actually did give an earlier degree.
But what's the point of a girl having an Alamia degree? What can she do with it?
Well, I mean, I asked him that. So he said some of these girls, just because they get married doesn't mean, you know, that they just close that shop and make chapatis forever. So in some cases, the girls will actually teach at madrasas. And it's not until they decide to start having a family that she'll then exit the labor market. So, you know, many of the girls' madrasas do have female teachers, although they never seem to have enough female teachers. And so many of the male teachers will either teach behind a curtain or they'll pipe their voice, you know, into the classroom from afar. But they do. I mean, they do seem to do things. Some of the girls, because the terminal degree is the equivalent of a master's, some of them will go, you know, to universities. Some of them can, because it is a master's, they can teach Arabic and Islamic studies in public institutions as well. So as long as they do that terminal degree, they actually have a number of employment opportunities available to them. And I'm glad you asked that because it reminded me of one other point I wanted to make. We often get besieged by this idea that madrasa graduates are unemployable. And that really didn't seem to bear out. Because the madrasa or the Islamic education establishment is flush with funds, it's kind of like a welfare state. They basically absorb their own. So according to some of the administrators of the more popular madrasas, there's actually a waiting list for their graduates to go to other schools and to teach. So, you know, again, they have an incentive to misrepresent the fact. But, you know, even talking to the occasional students that we met, I never got the sense that they were fearing unemployment. That they're, you know, either as a qari, you know, a person who is a professional reciter of the Quran, as a qati, a person who gives speeches, or, you know, even the muazzam, you know, there are various sort of Islamic occupations that are available to these folks. And unemployment, from their point of view, doesn't appear to be a problem. Now, what I'd like to do is get some economist to go back to the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey and actually see if there's any truth to that. But I suspect that because madrasa enrollments are so rare, that we wouldn't be able to determine that. But nonetheless, it's on my to-do list. Find a World Bank economist to sort of see if what they say is true.
Chris, I wanted to take you back to one of your opening remarks, which was about the madrasas being places where a permissive or conducive environment for militancy may be created, as opposed to places that actually produce militants directly. And I assume that that's the purpose of this sort of tables 8 and 9 that you have here, which indicate that the degree of militancy in students is high and in instructors is very high.
Right.
So I'm wondering what sort of conclusion, as compared to the Urdu and English medium education. And so I'm wondering what is your conclusion that you drew from your trip and from these tables as far as the extent to which these madrasas are serving in some ways as sort of preparatory or recruiting grounds, you know, in the way that, you know, the CIA in the 1950s recruited almost all of its people from about 3 Ivy League schools.
And don't forget Mormons.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Sorry. Well, I want to take exception to, and if I said that, I want to correct that. I didn't say that these is producing militancy. I didn't say that. And I want to be very. If I did say it, I should not have had a mimosa for breakfast because that's not what I meant. First of all, I'm not sure if you when you walked in, madrasas educate about 1% of Pakistan's educational market. From what I've seen, like for example, I remember actually this hit me when I was at 15th Corps a couple of years ago near Srinagar. This was 15th Corps of the Indian Army, sits right across the street from their counterparts in Pakistan, and they are responsible for a large segment of the counterinsurgency grid, or whatever you want to call it, because we're in a mixed audience, whatever you want to call it. They've got responsible for that part of the world. And I was able to go through some of the militants' manuals. And in fact, for those of you who want to see what some of them look like, Peter Chalk and I did a piece in Jane's Intelligence Review where we actually had some of the pages from these manuals published. These manuals are sophisticated. The one that really impressed me, and it wasn't distinctive, I mean, there's just one page and several manuals that were very much like this, was they had a breakdown of where you supplies that you need to make an IED and where you could get these things from the common Indian market. Looking at these manuals, these are not folks that can't read or write English, because these manuals had a lot of English. These are not folks that don't understand chemistry or math. And I was really at that point, I think this was in 2002, when I was really just trying to rationalize what I was coming to know of these groups, who they recruit and what they need to do those missions, and what we were being piped about, madrasas and militancy. It just didn't make sense, and it still does not make sense. And the reason why it doesn't make sense is that this is an economic argument. It's an opportunity cost argument. When the economy is good, high-quality, well-educated people have certain opportunities that are available to them. And the cost of being a terrorist or a militant or a criminal or what have you is higher for those well-qualified people when times are good, relative to a person who's poorly qualified. But when the economy starts to sour, the opportunity cost for a higher quality person diminishes relative to when the economy is good. But it diminishes less for the lower quality person because they didn't have opportunity, they didn't have squat to begin with. And so there's been an economist, and I really like his work. His name is Ethan Bueno de Mesquita, and he wrote a paper called The Quality of Terror, and I encourage you to get it because of all these economists, Krugman, you know, you name them all, he's the only one that makes sense. Because one, he understands that terrorist groups impose a quality constraint, and he's able to square all of these different things that the different economists were finding, like the Krugman shop, for example, the Kruger shop. So during economic downturn, the proportion of more quality people become available relative to periods when the economy is good. So you take a country like, so basically what this means is if you're a terrorist recruiting outfit, you're always going to have more people who want to be terrorists than you actually have jobs for. So it may be that every 1% of the educational market who graduated from madrasas wants to be a terrorist. If I'm Lashkar-e-Taiba or Jamaat al-Dawah, whoever I am today, I don't have to take that person. So what I'm going to argue is that I do not believe, based on what I know of these groups, and there are some exceptions, like, for example, people operating in Afghanistan, it's a much lower threshold to operate there. There are far less sophisticated attacks until quite recently, and there is space for madrasa students to operate there. And we know that, right, because we supported that effort back in the day. But for folks operating in Kashmir and in India, I don't believe they're coming from madrasas. So I don't believe that they contribute to supply. But what I said was the one thing that we've seen not a lot of analysis on is what I'm going to call the demand for terrorism. By demand for terrorism, I mean support for terrorism. Who supports their activities? Who thinks that it's good if their son goes and dies in Kashmir? So the only study I know, and I hate to say this, is the one that Brian Shepard and I did, the Pew data, where we're looking at determinants of who supports terrorism. And I'm not going to talk about that here, but the reason why people don't do it is that it's actually there are very few data sources that allow, first of all, who's going to say in a survey, yes, I support terrorism? That's the first thing. But the evidence that I've seen from that work that Brian and I did, from Salim Ali, from Tariq Rahman, is that madrasas are creating students who have a worldview that is less tolerant than others. This doesn't mean that they're terrorists. It doesn't mean that they're militants. It just means that they have personal views that may be problematic. And when I talk to Pakistanis about it, they say this is our problem because we have students that are being produced with this educational system who have a worldview that means that we can't live at peace with ourselves, i.e. Shia, Sunni, Barelvi, Deobandi, and we have students that don't necessarily, who are not capable of living at peace with our neighbors, i.e. India. So I didn't want to give the impression that these are militants. I want to give the impression that even Pakistani establishment types are concerned that the students coming out of these schools have worldviews that are problematic for its domestic politics. And as so many of you know, Pakistan's been besieged by sectarian violence. This is something that Pakistan takes very seriously. And I think this is why the government is so interested in trying to reform the curriculum, because the evidence is there that it contributes to sectarian violence. And I apologize if I was too glib and didn't say that right the first time. Yes, sir. Ambassador Sahib.
Thank you. I want to make one comment and ask a small question. About educating women for a few years, I think it would be wrong to think of this purely in terms of employment opportunities. They are part of society. Their parents wish them to be educated, to be better mothers, better wives, have run better families. And I think that is certainly part of the impulse. I mean, and should be recognized as such. Now, I have two small questions. One of them is that in your table 8, that fairly bloodthirsty observation about Kashmir are attributed to students, also to instructors.
Yeah.
My question is, are there comparable data for non-madrasa students of the same mm-hmm. locality and the same age group? I think that would be an interesting contrast. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is that the non-madrasa students would say much the same.
Well, they are there, because you've got Urdu medium and English medium.
Mm-hmm. English medium?
No, no, I'm sorry, I didn't clarify. Urdu medium are generally public schools, and English medium are private schools. So what you're looking at is exactly what you talked about. These are, in the paper that I'm writing, these are not my data. I did not do this survey. I am, however, very keen in funding someone to do this survey in a much more statistically significant way. Again, this is still a convenient sample. So what they're doing is they interviewed only students that are in the 10th grade or in the madrasa system comparable to the 10th grade. So, for example, the madrasa students, they're going to be much older because
so it does show
their cohorts.
A greater readiness for combat on the part of the
They're less tolerant.
Yes.
They're less likely to support. Exactly. Yeah. That was the point that he was making.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. My second question is about curriculum development. It has been argued, I mean, I know about India, I don't know about Pakistan, but I imagine that they're pretty similar. I think that what you were saying is pointing in actually two different directions. One is that you have a medieval-type curriculum which is set and has not advanced. And the other is that the same madrasas, or some of them, are developing a kind of secular type of education because this is what the public demands. This phenomenon is certainly to be seen in India. But it has also been argued, I think very interestingly by people who really do know about this, that curriculum development in the madrasas, in India at any rate, or in some madrasas, has been more striking than curriculum development in the universities, in the regular universities, which, according to some, are stuck with Macaulay in the mid-19th yep. century. So is there any sign that you have, that you encountered, that what seems almost visible today, the people talking about that, which after all is a part of classical education and can certainly be accommodated in that spirit. Has there been any move, any development within the madrasas since 1947 to update, to advance what is being taught today now significantly different from what it was half a century ago?
Well, on your first point about women, I'm really glad you raised it because I've made this argument elsewhere. The value, as you said, and the same thing goes for educating boys, too. It's not just the return to the labor market, but educating women has a particular return that I don't think folks particularly appreciate. If you were to compare Bangladesh, the trajectory that Bangladesh has pursued since 71 and since in Pakistan since the same, basically when Bangladesh and Pakistan had their not-so-amicable divorce, Bangladesh achieved a fertility transition very quickly, and I'm not going to say Bangladesh is the best example for everything. It's got serious problems, but it did achieve a fertility transition in an environment which most people would say was not coercive, which given a resource-constrained country like Bangladesh, that's very impressive. Most of the, economists that I know that have looked at this have attributed this fertility decline to a couple phenomenon. One is educating girls. Educating girls is a number of things, and it has a cascade effect of payoffs or return to investment. One, it tends to delay their age at marriage. So the more you educate girls, that is to say, the longer you delay the fact they're going to get married. The longer you delay marriage, you increase the likelihood that you're going to decrease their overall fertility. Three, and this is what I call a second order, but I have to say perhaps one of the most important effects is that the best predictor of educational achievement of all children is actually the mother's educational level of education, not the father's. So if you look at the development literature and the demography literature, one of the best things that a country can do is to invest in its girls. It delays marriage, it delays fertility, and it has very high payoffs in subsequent generations. So you can see very quickly the cascade effects that accrue from educating girls. And I might add, Iran is another really interesting example of this. Iran has a very high education rate for women. Even though Khomeini encouraged very large fertility rates basically to fund cannon fodder in the Iran-Iraq war, Iran very quickly came to terms with this emergent demographic bulge. And so it began within a very Shia Islamic context, legitimizing birth control, family control, and educating girls. So I'm really glad that you raised that point. And I've made it another four. I didn't make it here, and I regret doing so, because I didn't want to give the impression that it only, to your point, the only value is working. There's so many other.
There was only specific for that type of
degree. Right. So you said we went off in funny tangents. But to your other point about Macaulay, now this is a very consistent criticism that I heard from madrasa people, that okay, we're getting beat up because our curriculum is archaic, but the public school system is still using Macaulay. Now I would argue there's a big difference between 19th century and 11th century, but madrasa people. I'm not saying what was better. I really don't know. But I did hear that madrasa people felt that. There were many cases of their success stories that were not being adequately celebrated. That in fact they were trying to be innovative. And I think the example that they would give would be setting up these public schools. But what struck me was that what they were doing in these public schools was very different in spirit from what they were doing in madrasas. And madrasas, what they were trying to do is not some the curricular advances that they were putting in. When I looked at it, frankly, it seemed to be more window dressing to me. But if in fact they adhered to this standard that you have to be a 10th grade graduate to come to a madrasa, they're furthering the argument that no one should tamper with their curriculum because they are a specialization in the same way as an engineering school or a medical school. So on the one hand, while some madrasas are really being pioneering and coming up with these new educational arrangements, on the other hand, some of their so-called worldly subjects are actually being scaled back. So, for example, some madrasas have simply stopped teaching math altogether, although, if they're teaching, a 10th century text, I suppose math is math. But so on the one hand, while some madrasas are really innovating, and I think they were kind of free to because they were largely free of government oversight, there's also a lot of evidence that they're not. In other areas, they aren't really being as innovative with their own curriculum as they are in these sort of extra madrasa ventures. But I, unfortunately, to be straight up with you, we visited 10 madrasas, and there are, between 13,000 and 10,000. And so I don't really want to say anything. But on the other hand, we visited the Vafaqs, and the Vafaqs can actually speak for what's going on in their other institutions. But I think it's a really good point that you raise. And I know my colleague who's doing the India part, I mean, he's talked about some of these issues that you identified as well.
In your presentation,
is wearing a vest.
No comments, only questions. In your presentation, you mentioned about leg in two canoes. There are people, some families sending their children to madrasa and other children to the public education or private education or whatever. In that part of the world, the phenomenon of dropouts is really, really great. And did you, in your study, did this come out that those who go to the madrasas, they are perhaps dropouts from the pressured schools, the public
yes.
school or the private school, because there's a lot of pressure on achievement, on sort of going to a certain level. Maybe the dropouts go there, and there the madrasa, the teachings are such that perhaps children can be absorbed and kept in the school system for whatever grades you have mentioned. In your study, does it mention it?
Well, the issue of dropouts came up, and of course every mother says, oh, no, no, we have no dropouts. And then you push further. Now, the problem with dropouts, there are a couple of problems with dropping out from a secular school and going to a madrasa, is that you have to start from scratch with Darsay Nizami. So if you drop out, you know, and you decide to start from scratch, there's a cohort issue. People did mention that that was an option. The real issue that I encountered with these, that they were much more forthright in talking about, is that because not all madrasas have the same competency at all levels, you do have a lot of movement from one madrasa to another. And madrasa administrators were loath to say they had dropouts. But they said, well, you know, maybe they went to another madrasa. So it's really difficult to get dropout rates. But yeah, everyone talks about. Now, I do want to tell you a very interesting story, and I don't even know what to think about this. When I went to a madrasa, a very important madrasa in Karachi, I saw these two young gentlemen from Atlanta. They spoke in the same way that my cousins in Atlanta speak. They were very clearly, they had their shalwar kameez with a baseball cap on and a big bulky sweatshirt. these had to be the saddest young boys I'd ever met. And I'm like, so how did you go from Atlanta to this madrasa? Well, basically, the crime that this young man committed, and he was flunking out of the sixth grade in Atlanta. He has no family in Pakistan, but his father, a diligent cab driver, had basically said, you're not going to cut it in the sixth grade here. We're going to send you to a madrasa. And for good measure, they included his young brother. These gentlemen do not know Urdu. And I have to say, when I began talking to some of my counterparts in the British Foreign Office, they're also seeing this phenomenon. And I am not averse to Islamic education, and I don't think anything I've said would suggest that. But what I am averse to is taking a kid from the United States, and I think parents are required by law to educate their children to a certain level. And what the children were doing at this madrasa, they were not studying any secular subject. They were doing Hifz-e Quran. So from the sixth grade, and this kid wasn't the sharpest kid I've ever met, he will probably take the full 4 years to do Hifz-e Quran. A really sharp kid can do it in 2 years. If you think about that, it's mind-boggling. So he's going to go back to Atlanta after completing Hifz-e Quran when his peers are in the 10th grade. What in the world is this kid going to do? And, so I began asking around to sort of see, you know, how many American officials are aware that we may be having this problem. Our British counterparts are very aware of it, and they are trying to figure out legislative ways, because it's not an argument against Islamic education. These kids are coming back to the United States, and what do you do with them? I mean, he's 4 years out of sync after already, you know, failing the sixth grade. So from what I can tell talking to my counterparts, not only is the madrasa solution available for Pakistani dropouts, but apparently for diasporans as well.
Yeah, Christine, a question about table three. And it's the same kind of comparative question. It's the middle line of change from 47 to 2000. Has anybody run these figures against the comparable figures for the growth of population as a whole, which I think is about 300%?
Yes.
For what is now Pakistan, and for the growth in public schools on the one hand and private schools on the other, because you may find that these figures are not wildly out of line for the growth of education per capita in general in Pakistan. I mean, that would be another point.
I'm glad you raised that, because I explore that issue to the extent that I can in this monograph I'm writing. Most people, as you rightly note, I mean, it sounds so obvious that, of course, all educational establishments are going to grow in a way that's correlated to the population growth and in correlation to the age structure, because many of these countries are very young. They have very large youth bulges. So we would actually expect the growth to be not linear because, you know, population growth is exponential.
You'd have to deflate that 2,600% by quite a figure.
Right. And by the way, that's why I prefer the World Bank study, because that's what the World Bank study does. The World Bank study actually uses a couple different slices of the data. And what they end up doing is basically looking at market share, which is the number of students in each sector divided by the total eligible students for enrollment. for precisely that reason. So in other words, you know, they are deflating it for changes in the population growth. But it's I'm glad you raised it here because, you know, I'm doing a lot of work on Bangladesh these days, dealing with government folks on Bangladesh. And you think the data in Pakistan's crappy. Well, in Bangladesh, I mean, getting data is like wrestling, you know, doing dentistry on a shark. It's really, really hard. And you hear people, you know, talking about, oh, the expansion of the madrasas, but not a single person can tell you, well, okay, what was the increase in the student population for that cohort over this same period of time? And they look at you like you just said something in Greek. So I'm really glad you raised it, because I think that the other thing you have, is you said, and that's why I like the World Bank data, because they're looking at changes in market share over time. And you can do that with the Pakistani Integrated Household Survey because it's done in waves at regular intervals. So you can actually, and if you look at the World Bank study, that's exactly what they do. They track market share geographically and across time using the PIHS.
Because you'd not only get 1% for total market share, but you'd get on that figure 1, 2, and 300% perhaps.
Correct.
Rather than 2,600.
I mean, correct. Absolutely. Well, look at the World Bank study, and if it doesn't meet that, because we're basically, I'm trying to find an economist that can replicate that for Bangladesh. And so if you find that that doesn't answer your questions, if there's other things we should build in, let me know.
Chris, yes. May I follow up on that? And then I add a couple of questions. In British India, there are 137 universities. Today in India, there are 8,047 universities. So there's this huge expansion at the university level. So why shouldn't there be a huge expansion at the school level?
That's
just a follow-up.
And I'm in violent agreement with that.
To what you brought up. My questions are a little different. One is, what percentage of Afghans are there, Afghan students? You're talking of, you know,
yeah.
Pakistanis, I'm talking of the Afghan students.
Well, I mean, there's
let
no...
Let me just follow up the other one. The other one is, you talked of the English language manuals for terrorism. Are these the ones that were developed by the University of Omaha?
No, these are not manuals. These are notebooks.
Okay, what were these developed at Omaha?
Just answer your question. These are notebooks that these kids taught in their class. And that's different from that wonderful set of textbooks that was developed by a USAID grant. No, these are very different. These are, you know, basically these are just copies that, you know, kids are making pictures of their Kalashnikov and what have you. But your first question, it's unknowable. But what is knowable is that the International Islamic University in Islamabad, they used to get a majority of their students from Afghanistan's madrasas, because the Afghanistan madrasas were heavily rooted in Arabic. So those students had very good Arabic skills. And so they were very competitive. So what the International Islamic University of Islamabad says is that over time, whereas they used to get a lot of Afghan students from Afghanistan's madrasas, and then when their education got disrupted, they completed their studies in Pakistan's madrasas for a number of reasons, in part because the Islamic University of Islamabad has expanded their offerings and they're getting a lot more non-madrasa students, and those are English medium. So if you talk to those people, they can tell you that over time their share of these Afghan madrasa students is declining. But they're the only ones that actually kept administrative data on this subject. And oh, by the way, everyone we visited said, oh, no, there are no foreign students here because we're not allowed to have foreign students by the government anymore. But, you know, curiously enough, when you look around the foreign the student population, there were a lot of foreigners.
Just a note, you visited 10 madaris. This idea that they take them only after they've got the matric degree, that is true for a few,
correct,
handful of the really elite, like Jamia Ashrafia, Banuri, a couple of others that focus on university level education up through PhD level, and a couple of them I think are actually authorized by the government to grant PhD degrees as well as Islamic degrees, not just equivalents but full-fledged PhDs. The vast majority of madrasas or madaris are primary, middle, and high school level. The top ones may have like a prodigy class or something like that. One of the reasons the numbers are so hard to figure out, and that the discrepancy between ICG and World Bank is unbelievable.
Well,
even
ICG
taking
just screwed up their math.
Even that minor problem of the decimal point and the number of students, even leaving that aside, we wrestled when I was in the embassy in Islamabad with how to account for that discrepancy. And a good bit of it can be accounted for by whether you're going talking part-time or full-time students.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Awful lot of people send their kids to state schools and then, like Hebrew school or Sunday school, go to learn memorize the Quran. But the those were the 2 points I wanted to clarify on that.
No, you're right, and I did make that, maybe not as much as I should have. These are the elite schools. They can impose whatever standards they want because they're always going to get more. But that being said, we went to one. We went to the main madrasa in Balochistan, and arguably, you know, they were in the same position. They nominally said that they did this, but when you actually push them on it, in truth, they really didn't have that requirement. And in fact, it was possible to go to that madrasa, and this was the most important madrasa in all Balochistan, without ever having had any worldly, as they call it, you know, worldly education whatsoever. So I share your dubiety that, you know, interviewing, you know, we visited the Yales, not the Ball States. So what the other folks are doing, it's impossible to say. But the people I interviewed who were doing work with these secondary madrasas, you know, their point of view was that these are beyond reform. I mean, there's just nothing there. The quality of students are abysmal. The quality of teachers are abysmal. There just really wasn't.
In other words, they're comparable to the state schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I mean, that's the madrasa that people would say. Oh, yeah. So how do they differ from the state schools?
Yeah.
But the thing about the full-time, part-time enrollment, the World Bank controls for that because they only look at full-time students.
Yeah.
The other problem with the World Bank study is that because it's a household-based instrument. If there are students at a madrasa that are not tied to a household, like orphanages.
Orphans, yes. That was another major factor.
Yeah. They did build a margin of error. So, for example, they said, well, let's just pretend that every orphan in Pakistan goes to a madrasa. How would that affect the estimate? And what they end up getting, they end up saying, okay, fine, anywhere between 1 and 3% attend a madrasa on average. And by the time you correct the ICG's math error, they're actually, I mean, they overlap. They're within each other's margins of error.
Yeah, my guess is that if you take every kid who has ever experienced any kind of madrasa education, full-time or part-time, or kids who just go there for a couple of years and then go back to the state system, which also happens quite a bit, then you're getting very substantial numbers. But, you know, it could be up to 8, 10%, something like that. But most of those will only have gone part-time or only for a couple of years and then done something else.
Well, you know, the World Bank does something, and I didn't go into this, because actually it's hard to explain. They did what's called a cohort analysis. So they were trying to get a sense of what's the prospective interest. So in other words, if a person said they were interested, let's say we interviewed them in 1981, they said they were interested in a madrasa or an Islamic education, they wouldn't necessarily appear into a madrasa system until N years later. Or if a parent said they wanted their kid to go to a madrasa, that child would not appear as an enrollment for several years later. So the World Bank should try to get at what you were looking at, use the life history form. And they looked at cohorts. And actually, I may have it right here. Since we're a small enough group, I can bore you with it. They found a really interesting bathtub effect, which kind of says what you were saying, but it's denominated differently. Where's the bathtub? Oh, here it is. So you can see this bathtub effect. Mm-hmm. So down here, we're looking at a cohort 1944 to 1948, and this is basically interest in religious education. And then this over here is 1988 to 1984, and this is because they're using the Pakistan census, and this is how the ages are given. So what they actually find is that people express an interest in the educational interest in Islamic schools is actually declining until you get to the cohort of 59-63, and then it starts increasing again. So this is interesting because the traditional wisdom says that this actually starts to spike with the Zia years and the war in Afghanistan. And if you actually use this prescriptive, this sort of prescriptive, prospective cohort analysis, you actually see the interest begins to change much earlier.
Yeah.
So, in other words, did Zia just sort of seize the bull by the horns, or did he do more to instigate that bull? This would suggest that this interest in Islamic education happened well before Zia came onto the scene.
Or you could get an overlay effect where you had a rising trend of interest in madrasa education, on top of which Zia established additional madaris in order to create cannon fodder for Afghanistan.
Exactly.
And certainly that accounts for a substantial amount of it.
But this was an interesting thing that they did, but it pushes my econometrics understanding to explain how. I mean, I couldn't do this if someone offered me $1 million. So this, but anyway, this is very interesting. For it kind of, I think, addresses what you're talking about.
Did Zia go to a madrasa?
Don't believe it.
Went to St. Stephen's College in Delhi.
No, he never went to a madrasa. He graduated from government high school in Simla.
In Simla, and then he went to Delhi, the St. Stephen's College, the most prestigious college here.
And he claimed to be a madrasa graduate.
Thank you.
Yes. Oh, thank you.